Hello, and thanks for listening. My name is Mike McMeekin, and I'm the Executive Director of Engineering Change Lab USA. On March 10th and 11th, 2020, we held the 8th Engineering Change Lab USA Summit. One of our provocateurs for Summit 8 was Guru Madhavan, who is the Augustine Senior Scholar and Director of Programs at the National Academy of Engineering. Guru's provocation at Summit 8 continued the partnership between the National Academy of Engineering and ECL USA. Guru, thanks for joining us at the summit, and thanks for this follow-up conversation.
A pleasure, Mike. It was a treat to be at the summit.
One of the focus areas for Summit 8 was to explore the future of engineering through the lens of biomedical engineering. Guru's experience in the medical device industry and his thinking and writing about the way that engineers address problems provided a great provocation to the participants at the summit. Guru, in your provocation at Summit 8, you gave us some examples of the engineer's role in dealing with wicked problems involved in improving public health. Can you recap what makes a problem wicked and give us some example of the wicked problems of the future?
Oh, that's a really good question to start off here. A wicked problem fundamentally involves multiple identities. And I use the word identities deliberately so that it resonates across multiple levels here. And to better understand the wickedness within a problem space or that affect the kinds of solutions we as engineers are developing, it could be helpful to go back to the areas or maybe look at a loose hierarchy of the kinds of problems that eventually constitute wickedness. And there are classes of problems where engineering and engineers at large has gained tremendous experience. And in fact, we have gained enormous mastery over certain classes of problems, what we might just call hard problems. And these are usually driven by market requirements, social desires, customer preferences, you name it. Okay, and we have a real good understanding of the solution space and the possible range of solutions here in this case. And that's usually because we're able to bound the problem and we have deep confidence in doing so. And a hard problem really involves a finite starting point and a finite ending point. And of course, iterations can help produce different kinds of solutions for these hard problems. So in a literal sense, you can solve, you can materially attack, you can mathematically address a hard problem. So this is where we have the most experience in. A second class of problems are, generically speaking, are those, call them soft problems that often encounter political variables and behavioral elements here. And the kind of example that I would like to relate to here is something that we all experience on a daily basis, yet we can't really solve that problem per se. And that's traffic. And how do you better optimize in the spirit of the solution? And how do you get to a good enough solution, not the best possible outcome that was possible in a hard problem, but a good enough, what people might call satisfying. That's the kind of a problem that can be resolved, not solved per se, much like how a clinician would approach the diagnosis. And again, these are the concepts that I'm borrowing liberally from Russ Eckhoff, the management theorist. And then you can call a third class of problems messy, which fundamentally start with disagreements. You know, compared to a hard problem, which often starts with agreements, like let's explore the bounds of the issue and the kinds of solutions we want, messy problems often start with disagreements. And that's often the case that we all we can see in opinion-rich environments. And oftentimes, the outcomes are unpredictable. And messy systems innately involve value sets, belief systems, and individual ideologies acknowledged or hidden. And I think these are the kinds of issues where engineering does not have enough experience in. And unlike the hard problems where we have enormous experience in, and soft problems where we are really getting good at, thanks to incredible insights from our colleagues in the realm of social psychology and behavioral psychology and whatnot. So we are getting really good at those things. But messy problems, I would say that we are practically in the kindergarten version of our education here. And you put all these three things together, not in a standard chemical way. The combination of this hardness, softness, and messiness creates this wickedness. And I think by stating it that way, I also want to generate a kind of a basic confidence here, saying that to better approach wicked problems, we need to get good at understanding wicked problems. And I think this hardness, softness, messiness approach could help help us at least get better grips at the wicked problems that we are dealing with.
Okay, I'd like to move into now a little bit different area, Guru, and talk about and from the from your background and experience in biomedical engineering. What aspects of the practice of biomedical engineering can serve as models for transforming other engineering disciplines?
And this is a really insightful question here. I was originally trained as a control systems engineer, and I all of my graduate degrees and professional practice were all in biomedical engineering. And by taking that approach, I had to move dramatically away from the standard perspective of controls to the realm of complexity. That is a deliberate move from control systems to complex systems. And therein you deal with the adaptation and dynamic behavioral elements that often drive your thought process here. So in that regard, biomedical engineering as a kind of a field of inquiry or as a realm of practice emerged from the convergence of numerous other existing approaches. And if you look at even the very origins of engineering, which was a lot more comprehensive than what we now realize, because since especially in the past century, we have heavily specialized and super specialized, and that's the case even in biomedical engineering. And as the joke goes in medicine, there's a right ear surgeon and a left ear surgeon, and how do you really attack the system at large is the question that we need to think about. But overall, by using principles of biomedical systems, or if you want to consider even larger scale issues such as population health, what we have as an opportunity is to look at the variety of interacting elements. And that has deep connections to how circulation works within your body, how your neurons fire, and how pandemics spread in society. So one of the areas at least we can begin to get inspiration from in terms of in terms of implications for other engineering disciplines is, how do you delay the production of what's called lock-in? How do you suspend your tendencies to quickly get down to requirement specifications and get to work on developing something and then do this? I'm a huge fan of the concept of rapid prototyping, but for when you're dealing with complex systems, you might want to really engage with the complexity at large first. That is, not quickly jump into the elementals of the issue here, so that before understanding the issues at large here. So I think the basic idea is, how do you delay the lock-in? I don't think engineers are there yet to kind of completely avoid lock-in, but I think we can productively delay to our own fruitful benefit.
Well, it seemed to me that, as I observed at Summit8, the huge emphasis that is placed on research and development in healthcare in general and biomedical engineering's role in that, that there is this much greater opportunity to explore implications and delay that lock-in that is not present in other engineering practices.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move on. In a recent article that you wrote in the National Academy's The Bridge publication, you talked about the philosophies of Ove Arup, who's the founder of the global design firm Arup. Did you see any correlations between Arup's philosophies and the work of Engineering Change Lab, USA?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I've become a huge fan of Ove Arup in recent months, especially. Although I encountered his work in a more serious setting a few years ago. I was in the British Library doing some research, and I happened upon a letter that was written by Walter Gropius, the founder of the Bauhaus movement, to Ove Arup, and it was a small letter, and the words composite minds really jumped out at me from that letter, which really was a celebration of Ove Arup's mentality, so to speak. And I definitely see quite a bit of connection in that particular individual, Ove Arup's philosophy, and the incredible work and the portfolio of ambitions that the Engineering Change Lab has. Because one of the lines that Ove Arup often talked about to his firm members and to the rest of the community was, look, in an approximate sense, it goes something in the lines of, what we decide to do is much more important than how to do it. And I think this this has great implications in terms of how engineering does it, because we are often focusing on the mechanism of getting something done. How do you achieve certain things? And how do you abstract out beneficially from that mechanistic approach, which is extremely important, crucial, and almost a defining attribute of engineering, to a slightly higher level question, so that you can better confront the range of questions that think Arup thought involved so social, political, ethical issues that are capable of causing instant confusion. And engineers often feel that they are in the responsibility of producing clarity or alleviating confusion and so forth. But in this case, it's almost counterintuitive. How do you confuse yourself to the extent that the results that come out are counterintuitive and beneficial and socially relevant and accepted? And I think that's something even difficult to digest, especially among engineers. And I kind of get a feeling that that may have been what Ove Arup might have gone through himself as a person, when he used to talk about what are the moral aims of engineering. And I can imagine circumstances where his fellow engineers or team members or his other industry leaders thought, what is he talking about? To the point that his impression of what engineering should be doing as a responsibility, as a rigorous practice, was better appreciated by conceptual artists than engineers themselves. So sometimes these ideas take a long time to be transferred even within. And I think that's the nature of the questions that we are all confronting. He often talked about how engineering responsibility goes beyond just merely meeting a client's need or producing profits, even though that's also a defining attribute of modern engineering industry. And I'm really delighted that the Engineering Change Lab's work really gets us into this line of questioning explicitly, comfortably, non-threateningly, and importantly, empoweringly. And I think that's the importance of the work you and colleagues are doing in the Engineering Change Lab, Mike.
Well, thank you. And that quote that you cited, I think, really captures the transformation we're trying to work toward regarding the future of engineering. What we decide to do is much more important than how we do it. So I'll remember that. Guru, thanks again for joining us at Summit 8, and thanks for our conversation today. I enjoyed it.
A pleasure, Mike.